The Cause of All Nations is focusing on an international look at the American Civil War, and we tend to think of this as a battle between brothers, an American experience, but sort of what do we miss if we ignore that international involvement, that international view?
I think one of the things that I realized very early on in my research was that the whole world, at least the European world and the Latin American world especially, were watching this war, this American conflict. It was important to them, and partly because their governments, particularly in Britain and France, Mexico, were very involved. They had a lot at stake in the war, and there was concern that Britain or France or both might become involved in either a war with the United States or an alliance with the Confederacy. So they had a stake in it. They were also concerned, of course, that the war meant the disruption of the cotton trade, and that would bring and did bring great distress to all of Northern Europe, not just Britain. So the world was watching this, and they really followed it. The possibility of foreign intervention, the war, was real, and it would have made all the difference. This is something that I think most Americans who look upon this as, you know, our war, North and South, the generals, the politicians, they miss this if they don't look at the war on the world stage.
Well, you mentioned the cotton trade that Britain and France had interests in North America. Sort of, what were their views of North America? What did they think of the United States as war broke out?
The United States is kind of the exemplar of the democratic experiment or the republican experiment, that idea that people can govern themselves without kings, without priests, without a dynastic inherited monarchy. And in most of Europe, the republican experiment, which was raised, of course, with the French Revolution and continued to be an embattled project of French republicans, it had failed. And when I say failed, it had been squashed most recently in the great revolutions of 1848. And across Europe, you didn't have anything but monarchies, with a rare exception of Switzerland, which was a self-governing republic based, by the way, on the U.S. constitutional model of a federal government, and a few city-states like San Marino, one of my favorites that I talk about in the book. But there was an idea that self-government just didn't work, that it failed, and that sooner or later it would descend into either anarchy or despotism. And now the so-called Great Republic that they saw across the Atlantic was failing, was falling into civil war. And so for aristocrats, that is, those who supported monarchy and inherited status and power, they were delighted. The great experiment had failed in America, and it would discredit the republican experiment everywhere. But for others who believed that people could govern themselves and who were devoted to reform and to sustaining democracy and republicanism, at least in Latin America and Europe, they saw the American question as their own battle. They saw themselves having a lot at stake in the outcome of what they called the American question.
So you had these issues around the American question, both from the aristocracy, from the ruling class, from the general public. In terms of policy, in terms of tactics, what did the American Civil War present? I guess, was it an opportunity for these governments in Europe, pose an opportunity they wouldn't have had otherwise?
Yes. The crisis in America immediately ignited a whole revival of imperialist projects in the New World. Even before Fort Sumter, Spain invaded Santo Domingo and re-annexed it as part of the Spanish Empire. And then France, Spain, Britain met in London in October of 1861 and formed the Tripartite Alliance, and at the end of the year invaded Mexico, supposedly to recover international debts, but it was clear that, at least for France, they wanted to topple the republican government under Benito Juarez and to install a European monarchy. So it looked for a moment during the the American Civil War that empire and monarchy were on the ascendance in the New World as well as the Old. It opened an opportunity for the to reclaim lost empires in the Americas.
Well, I want to turn to the issue of recognition, because I think that if you don't follow international law or don't understand diplomacy, the idea of or the importance of being recognized might not be understood. For the South, for the Confederacy, how important was that?
It was everything, and I think it was more important even than they realized. The Confederacy, many of them thought they could just win their cause on the battlefield and that the North wouldn't really fight. But it soon became obvious that this was going to be a long, protracted war with massive citizen armies that would go on indefinitely in a war that was very difficult to compromise on issues of sovereignty. So immediately after they seceded, each of the states met in Montgomery, Alabama, to form a government of their own, they called it. They created a constitution with some important revisions of the old U.S. Constitution. They established a government. They appointed a president. They set up the whole apparatus of government and the trappings of government, the flag, which has been much in the news lately. They adopted uniform stamps, every money, all those things that go with being a nation. But it was very important for them to be recognized as a member in the family of nations. This seems, I think, to many just a kind of courtesy of international relations, but it wasn't. It was much more than that. To be recognized meant not only that your ambassadors, your envoys abroad, would be received in court, it meant that you could make treaties. It meant that you could make loans with other nations. It meant that you existed as a kind of corporate national entity. And without that, you were simply an aspiring nation that met informally and unofficially with other governments and that had no real standing under international law. Without recognition, this was just a rebellion, an insurgency. The Confederacy wanted very much to get full recognition of themselves as a sovereign nation. And the United States wanted to do everything they could to keep this as a civil war against an insurgency, a domestic rebellion, and to threaten war against any nation that gave aid or recognition to the rebellion.
And American Secretary of State William Seward, I believe the line is, anyone who aided the Confederacy, they would wrap the world in flames.
That's right, yes. Seward used that phrase in various different iterations. Often he would bring in a journalist or at a party with diplomats. He'd put a cigar in his mouth. He was always smoking a cigar. Strike a match and then light the cigar and issue one of these menacing threats, almost as though he welcomed the idea of a foreign war. Earlier, Seward had given speeches to the effect that if we have a foreign war, if we go to war against Spain after they invaded Santo Domingo, or France because they were threatening to take back Haiti, this would reunite Americans. It was the foreign war panacea, historians call it. They kind of make fun of it as a silly overreach by Seward. But it had its effect because the British and the French were afraid, this guy might be crazy, but we don't want to get into a war with the United States. The British had been in two wars with the United States, and neither of them came out well for them. Revolutionary War, the War of 1812. And by this time, too, as the war started, America had put 1 million men in arms. The United States had nearly 1 million in arms, and a fast-growing navy with ironclad ships that really would threaten the British military power, as great as it was in the world at that time. So Seward's threats did have a very powerful and important impact during the war.
What efforts did you see the South undertake to try to gain recognition?
The South had this idea that Europe would come to them, that they had this huge cotton supply. In 1860, the South was supplying about 80% of the world's cotton. And we think usually of Britain as the main center for cotton textile production. But it wasn't. All across northern France, Belgium, even in Italy, and on into Central Europe, the Industrial Revolution had taken hold and cotton textiles were extremely important. There were other sources for cotton in India, in Egypt, but those were not well developed and the cotton was considered inferior. And so all of a sudden, this trade in cotton was disrupted. And the South saw this as great leverage that they would have. In fact, they were the ones to impose, Jefferson Davis imposed an embargo on cotton exports, with the idea that if they created or threatened to create a cotton famine in Europe, that Europe would come to them. That didn't work. Again, the fear of war with the Union was such that Britain and France waited and stood back and did not come in to get the cotton. At one point, the Confederacy offered a huge bribe to France, to Napoleon III, separate from Britain, and said, look, if you come in first and break this blockade, you will have like a 20-year low tariff or no tariff trade agreement with us. You and your merchants will make enormous profits, and you will surge ahead of Britain as an industrial as well as military power and a power in the New World. And the cotton bribe, as they called it, was very tempting. This was issued in July of 1862, but the French didn't take it. Again, they were concerned about war with the United States and not so sure they wanted to get into bed with the Confederacy.
I want to ask about the issue of slavery, the central question within the Civil War, because in the North, you had tension around that issue. Lincoln,
yes,
starting off the war, did not publicly say that that was the reason. Why did you have this tension?
We're having echoes of that same kind of ambiguity today, aren't we, about, you know, was the war about slavery? The South, during the secession winter, 1860-61, several of the states issued declarations of causes and made it very clear that the reason they were seceding from the nation was because it was now under the control of a party that was hostile to the institution on which their livelihoods, their economy, their safety, they believed, rested, and that this was a threat to slavery. Once the war began, and once they went abroad, they decided to kind of cover that and to deny that slavery was the issue. Slavery had always been part of the Union. They were not changing anything about slavery. They simply were splitting off from the Union because they wanted to maintain low tariffs. This was, of course, very appealing to British and French cotton importers, and that slavery was not the cause or the motive for secession. Now, you can understand why they wanted to downplay that and to play up more kind of morally neutral issues like the tariff, or they talked about just the conflict between agrarian and industrial society, that this was a natural kind of organic conflict that Europeans could understand. Now, the question is, why did the Union deny slavery to be the main cause that they were fighting for? This is what historians and defenders of the South have talked about. Because Lincoln, in his inaugural address on March 4th, now, mind you, all of the secession of the seven Deep South states has taken place before Lincoln even took power. There's a lot of talk about Northern tyranny and the injustice of this administration, but in fact, Lincoln wasn't even in power at the time that they seceded. So it's the anticipation of incursions against the South, let's say, that leads to secession. Lincoln had to deny that he had any power, and then he went further to deny that he had any intention to interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed. Lincoln was believed strongly in the rule of law. He understood that the Constitution did not allow the federal government or the president to interfere with slavery in the states. It was actually a strong states' rights speech, his inaugural address on March 4th, 1861. But he reminded Americans that the Republican Party platform was to not allow the further spread of slavery into the territories or outside the existing boundaries of the United States. And the Republican idea was always that if you contain slavery and do not allow it to spread into areas with fresh land and to create this or to continue this kind of internal slave trade that allowed places like Virginia, for example, and South Carolina to export slaves to new fresh lands. Once you contained it, that you would strangle slavery, that you would force the states to come to terms with the future of an institution that was out of place and economically dysfunctional. That was the Republican idea. But furthermore, what Lincoln was trying to do was to say, look, this is a rebellion without cause. I do not threaten slavery in the states. These people are declaring their independence, first because of a kind of false fear, an ungrounded fear of abolitionist intentions of the Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln. And he wanted to demonstrate to the world that, and to those who might recognize the South, that this is a rebellion, an insurgency that is without any kind of moral, constitutional, or legal grounding or legitimacy.
So what moved Lincoln from making that that legal argument, this is an insurrection, mm-hmm. to embracing slavery as a central issue later on in the war?
Mm-hmm. Most historians have looked at this within Lincoln's mind or within the internal politics of the North and the North and South, and they see Lincoln kind of either awakening and evolving is the term they often use. But I try to tell that story within an international context, because the Emancipation Proclamation that he came to in September 1862, that was foreign policy as much as domestic policy. And let me explain why. Early on, Lincoln and Seward, they worked very closely in tandem. These were not rivals anymore. They were a team and a good working team. Lincoln understood that, and he was informed by his diplomats abroad, particularly Karl Schurz, a German radical, a 48er, as they call them, from the Revolution of 1848. Schurz had told him, after coming back from Spain, that all of the governments of Europe were monarchist, aristocratic, and they wanted nothing more than for the great republic, America, to fail and to prove the republican experiment a failure. But that the people, at least the liberal public, Schurz told him, were hoping for the Union not just to survive as a union, but to survive as an example of republican institutions, of freedom, of justice, of equality, and self-government. Democracy and anti-slavery were very closely tied here. And Lincoln said to him, this is in now January or early February of 1862, way before we think Lincoln had made this kind of moral turn toward emancipation, he tells Schurz, you may be right. You probably are right. No government in Europe is going to take the side of slavery against that of freedom. But, he said, we're not ready for that turn yet. And he actually invited Schurz to arouse public opinion, to prepare the public mind, as he said. Now, meanwhile, overseas, a number of foreign intellectuals were framing the war as a contest between aristocracy and republicanism, between slave labor and free labor, between ideas of inherited and fixed status and those of free and equal people with an open door to opportunity. And so they were beginning to frame this as part of a long historic struggle. And that was the appeal that the Union cause began to take on. Once Lincoln was able to make this a war against slavery, the Union had aligned itself with this liberal public opinion that Schurz had talked about earlier in the year. It took a while. It wasn't immediate, but that was the key, this public diplomacy campaign, this soft power appeal to Europe that I describe in The Cause of All Nations.
Well, as you mentioned, the South tended to steer the conversation toward morally neutral issues, economics, tariffs, but there were many other countries that had already abolished slavery. England had abolished slavery by this point. You had public sentiment in many parts of Europe against slavery. How did they tackle this issue of slavery when it did come up, or when they were forced to?
The South, for nearly 30 years before secession, had kind of shut off debate. Anyone who questioned the future of slavery was considered silenced within the South. Politically, they were shut down. They had castigated abolitionists, northern abolitionists, as people who were trying to ignite racial holocaust in the South. They kept using the example of Haiti as a kind of the horrifying, unthinkable alternative to maintaining slavery. And I think they weren't really used to facing honest debate about slavery. In Europe, Britain had abandoned slavery in 1833, France in 1848, the second time. Spain, of course, still maintained slavery in Cuba, in Puerto Rico. But it was regarded as a barbaric relic of the past and something that European civilization had moved beyond. Public opinion was decidedly against slavery. The Southern envoys who came over to Britain found it very frustrating. They would complain that the British and the French had just kind of made up their minds. John Slidell, the Confederate envoy in Paris, said that whenever he met people who wanted to talk about slavery, he would just change the subject to more agreeable topics because he found that he couldn't persuade them. William Yancey, who was a fire-eating secessionist and someone who wanted to reopen the African slave trade, was just disgusted with all this sentimental philanthropy, as they called it, about slavery in Britain. He said at one time in a letter to his brother, they have read Uncle Tom's Cabin and they believe it. They kind of despaired that they couldn't change their minds, but others sought to advance, let's call it propaganda, but persuasive literature that was trying to show the truth about slavery.
Well, that kind of gets to what I wanted to ask about next, because you alluded to it a moment ago, that there were voices that were framing this conflict, framing this war outside of the United States, and United States, the Confederacy, were involved in what we would term propaganda. What were some of those efforts?
The intellectuals, journalists, politicians, reformers of all kinds joined issue on both sides. And this is a war that was fought within a kind of modern press, large circulation, mass audience, newspapers, inexpensively produced and distributed with new steam print technology, telegraphs that connected the world, at least on land. The transatlantic telegraph had failed, but still Europe was within 11 days, 10 or 11 days of news that just would spread very quickly. And both sides, the North and the South, began to realize the value of public opinion, the importance of public opinion, or shaping, putting the public mind in the right direction, as one diplomat deftly put it, and that would bring pressure on these governments, even though they were not democratic governments. Leaders like Emperor Napoleon III in France were very concerned about public opinion. The French may not have had the right to vote or to... Well, they did have the right to vote, but it wasn't a very democratic society at that time under the Second Empire. But the French would go to the barricades if they didn't like the government. So there was a kind of ultimate vote there that Napoleon was concerned about. So both sides began to realize that public opinion was important. The Union found the most effective way of aligning itself with public opinion in favor of the Union or against slavery was to allow native authors to raise their pens on behalf of the Union and to, in France, to translate their works, to distribute their works to the English-speaking world, and to reprint their works in French, to get out the word that French liberals, in this case, usually Republicans, sometimes just liberal Catholics and monarchists, that they saw the Union as a historic brother with the French, the French reminded these French pro-unionists reminded the French that they were the midwives to the Great Republic's birth back in 1778, that the United States had been at odds with Britain. And so, you know, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the French saw Americans as potential allies in their geopolitical schemes. The Confederacy, in contrast, they were concerned about people who would speak for them. And often in Britain, their supporters would say, of course, slavery is a terrible institution, and but if you let the South become independent, they will free the slaves before the Union will. And talk like that made them very uncomfortable because they had no intention of letting their slaves go. But those were British interpreters of their cause. So the Confederacy instead tried to control the message. They set up one newspaper in London called the Index that was a kind of fount of information and truth, propaganda, if you will, on the Confederate side of things.
Well, one of the people involved in writing about the war was Karl Marx. How was he involved?
Karl Marx was very interested in America's Civil War. He was a 48er, a revolutionary, a communist, socialist, wound up in London after the Revolution of 1848, was writing his great tome, Das Kapital, and needed to earn money just to pay a rent, and hired out his pen to the New York Daily Tribune. And all leading up to the war, he was writing about European views of the American affairs. And during the war, when the war broke out, he continued for a short time only to write about the British press and the European press and how they covered American affairs. And it's some of his most brilliant writing. He's really, really got at it. And of course, Marx saw this as part of the ongoing class struggle that defined history. And here, often America, not in the industrial heartland of Britain, but often America, this feudal aristocracy, the last vestige of feudalism, was raising this counter-revolution against the bourgeoisie, representing free labor and industrial development. Of course, Marx took the side of the bourgeoisie in this war between the classes. And he began to see the emancipation of slave labor in America as a precedent for the emancipation of labor everywhere. Emancipation is a word that is used very broadly in European discourse at this time to discuss the emancipation of women, the emancipation of Jews, the emancipation of labor, as well as of slaves. And so Marx saw this as a great historic struggle. He was let go by the New York Daily Tribune, and then wrote for other European presses in German. It's all been translated. It's available online. And in addition to his public articles that he wrote are letters between him and Frederick Engels, the co-author of the Communist Manifesto. And because Engels worked in Manchester, they corresponded, and they were constantly talking about America's Civil War. It's a fascinating correspondence, and his Marx's and Engels' view of the war, first of all, was very important just because of their understanding of the war, but also through their writings to Americans and to the German-speaking public, they influenced and shaped the foreign view of the American Civil War.
Well, you had Europeans interested in the American Civil War. You had European governments, France and Spain, reexert themselves in the Western Hemisphere, but why did this never actually break out into an international military conflict? Why did it stay just at that diplomatic level?
It seems like they were on the brink of, the world was on the brink of world war several times. In the Trent Affair in December 1861, remember, the Union had captured at sea two Confederate envoys, Slidell and Mason, John Slidell and James Murray Mason, along with their secretaries, took them off this boat, put them in prison in Boston, and it caused a huge international conflict between Britain and the United States, and they were on the brink of war. The Confederacy was very happy to see this. They thought that this would mean an alliance with Britain, and it would mean their independence. And then the fuse was pulled, and Lincoln let the prisoners go, and all of that war fever that was building in London collapsed in the new year of 1862. Then again, each time you think, well, that's over, but in diplomacy, in war, there was a constant tension. And by the summer of 1862, the Union's Peninsular Campaign, McClellan was trying to capture Richmond and mounted this huge invasion, and it failed, and he was turned back. And then by the end of the summer, Lee's army was meeting with stunning victories at the Seven Days Battle, and then crossing the Potomac and into Maryland. Remember, Maryland was a slave state. It now surrounded the capital in Washington, and it appeared that the Confederacy was going to capture Washington itself. So the whole world was watching this. Meanwhile, the British government, Lord Palmerston and his Foreign Secretary Earl Russell, had decided that September that they would intervene in the American war, and they would do it this way. Under international law, it was permissible for third parties whose interests, that is, economic interests, were menaced by an ongoing conflagration within a nation or between nations. It was permissible for them to offer themselves, to offer their good offices, as it was put, to mediate peace. And furthermore, that if one party accepted and the other party refused, they were justified in recognizing that willing party and in establishing peace. Now, the United States wanted nothing to do with mediation. To mediate meant that you would recognize the Confederacy as a legitimate negotiating party. And they knew that mediation would lead to separation. There was no way you could do that. But the British were determined to do this. They were running out of cotton. They thought the war was unending. They saw both sides just pouring more and more men into this, and that the Union, with all its men, with all its industrial might, with all its material advantages, simply could not put down this rebellion. And they felt, too, there was a feeling, even among many anti-slavery liberal thinkers in Britain, that there's simply no way, especially in a democracy, that you can just crush rebellion, and that if people don't want to be governed by the Republican administration in Washington, it's never going to work. So there was a kind of fatalism there also. And in addition to this, I think there was a humanitarian concern. Sometimes cynics, I think, thought that this was just a guise for mediation, separation, and getting more cotton. But I think there was a growing public sentiment that these big wars with massive citizen armies and now new weaponry like the rifle, repeating rifles that could mow down people at hundreds of yards in a way that muskets could never do, that these wars were just senseless and endless, and that it would require third-party governments coming in to mediate peace, especially in these rambunctious democracies that couldn't govern themselves. All of these forces, it looked like in September 1862, just as Lincoln was drafting the Emancipation Proclamation, Europe was plotting to mediate and to bring an end to the war.
Well, the war did end in 1865. You know, looking at it from an international perspective, you know, if the war didn't turn out the way it did, then what?
The world would have looked very different. There are all kinds of scenarios. Usually we historians stick to the facts and not to alternative history, but all of the decisions that were made, of course, are based on alternative scenarios that they feared and tried to avoid. So one thing that we can consider is that the Monroe Doctrine would have been a dead letter, as it was during the war, that France had gained a foothold in Mexico, had established a government under this monarch, Emperor Maximilian I, and Spain in Santo Domingo, that those imperial powers would have maintained and probably expanded their influence in the New World. It seems clear, too, that had the slaveholding nation of the Confederacy come out of this victorious, that slavery would have gotten a whole new life. Cuba, Brazil, other strongholds of slavery would have held on, would not have abandoned slavery as they began to do in the 1870s and 1880s. I don't know when slavery would have disappeared, but it would have gotten a new lease on life had the Confederacy won. But I think the other thing was that the idea of democracy, the Republican experiment, as they called that, I think it would have really received a fatal blow had the Union failed. Very likely what we call the United States of America would have been divided further. The Midwest, for example, which depended on an outlet through the Mississippi, would have had to do business with the Confederacy. That might have brought great strains between the Northeast and the Midwest. And at least according to plan, Maximilian and the French wanted to take back much of the parts of Western America that had been ceded to the United States by Mexico, wanted to reclaim that. So there was a lot at stake. And one of my quotes is from a young Adolf Hitler in 1933, who, after dinner in Munich, talks about how the Americans had failed in this great war to establish a society based on racial hierarchy, and that instead they became this kind of mongrelized race of shopkeepers and pettifoggers. And I don't know how much Hitler knew about American history, but there was this idea, I think, that even at the time, that this war, this American war, would decide the future of government by the people. And that's why, you know, Lincoln's famous speech at Gettysburg really captured the essence of the war for so many people around the world. And that speech would have a long, long life in the rhetoric of Europeans, particularly British, of government of the people, by the people, for the people, and that it shall not perish, he said, from the earth. That was what this war was about, and that's what those men at Gettysburg died for. So, you know, this is part of the appeal, part of the soft power appeal, that framed the war as something much more than just a civil war over territory and sovereignty or tariffs.
Well, Don Doyle, I really appreciate your time this morning. I enjoyed the book and enjoyed the conversation, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I enjoyed talking with you about it.